This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 16th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to be looking at some developments, and the first two we're going to look at are in process as I speak. I'm recording this at 8 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on Sunday morning, March the 15th. And as of the time I started recording this, this is where things stood, as far as we can tell. May not be where we stand when I finish recording this, and it may definitely not be, and it probably won't be where we stand by the time you're listening to this, if you're listening to this sometime later on Monday, Tuesday, or whenever next week. So we'll deal with that. But we have some developments, and we have some things in process. Let's start with the in-process things. And we have a few things going in process, one of which is a development. And we'll start with this. This was an emergency proclamation signed by President Trump on March the 13th, 2020. He signed this proclamation. This is a letter that he then wrote to various department heads, including the Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. And what we're going to concentrate on here is the one paragraph in this letter that was written to Secretary Mnuchin. Right? This letter goes out. The emergency was declared under the Stafford Act, and that's somewhat important because it allows Treasury to do certain things that otherwise they cannot do. Most importantly, the paragraph in the letter from the President directed the Secretary to provide relief from tax deadlines to Americans who have been adversely affected by the COVID-19 emergency as appropriate pursuant to 26 U.S.C. 7508 Cap A. Now, some people have been freaking out over that who've been adversely affected. Let's back off for a second, and if you go to your tax service or just go online and take a look and find Internal Revenue Code section 7508 Cap A. If you read that, little a is the section relief is going to come under. And that provision has been used continuously. It's always used. Whenever there's a major disaster, like the tornadoes in Nashville, like the issues that arose with hurricanes in Texas, Florida, the other issues over time in the California wildfires, there's a disaster declared, and that allows the IRS to do things. What they've always done is under this specific provision, 7508 Cap A. That says that they can take actions to extend due dates, forgive interest, waive penalties for taxpayers who have been adversely affected by the emergency item, whatever it was. Treasury has traditionally used that language to mean, for instance, if you were, let's say, in the area in Houston a couple of years ago when the hurricane came on shore, everybody who was in the disaster areas got an extended time to file their returns. Nobody was asked to prove that they actually were adversely affected and they actually had damage or something and that that damage had somehow caused them to be unable to file their return. Rather, the IRS said, we're not getting into that discussion. We're just going to give blanket relief for everybody who was in the counties that were the subject to the disaster declaration. And realize, there are boundaries to counties, right? There's going to be somebody who on one side of the street was in the relief area, and on the other side of a street you're not. Okay, that's just the way boundaries work, hard boundaries. And so it wasn't required for the person just inside the disaster county to show they had been damaged. But these things also said that if you were outside the disaster area, but you could show that you had been harmed, those people did have to demonstrate an adverse effect, but if they did, then they got the same relief. We expect to see a similar rule here. I direct you back to Secretary Mnuchin's remarks earlier in the week. Secretary Mnuchin, when testifying before Congress, had made the statement that their plans were to give an extension to virtually everybody except the term Secretary Mnuchin used was the super rich. Now, we don't have an idea what Secretary Mnuchin means by the super rich, but presumably that's going to cover most of our clients. Remember where Secretary Mnuchin was before and the paycheck he was getting, and I'm working on the assumption that the average person believes the super rich are not them, so it's somebody who has higher net worth and higher income than them. So I'm going to guess that Secretary Mnuchin is not going to be talking about putting super rich at anybody with an AGI over $100,000. I'm going to guess we're going to be somewhere a little bit north of that figure. So we'll see what's coming. Now, the catch is, though, this letter itself does nothing for this purpose. It doesn't activate an extension. It directs the secretary to take action. We are still awaiting the action of the secretary. Clients have been reading, because I've seen the news stories, it says, President states we're going to waive the tax deadline. You know, President orders tax deadline extended. It's like that's true and not true. And the way I'd phrase it is, it's true that he has told the IRS to take a look at this, but we don't have details, and details really, really matter here. So it's one of those issues. No actual extension of the date has been made yet. Secretary Mnuchin did put out a statement Saturday related to the item we'll talk about next, but it didn't mention the extended dates. We've done nothing of that sort. So bottom line is, wait. We should, I would guess, see something next week. It is highly unlikely that we're going to get it in time to have any difference for the March 16th deadlines we're facing on the flow-throughs. So my guess is that's, you know, that might be covered retroactively, but it would be very risky to assume that you can go without an extension for March 16th right now. If you're listening to this before the extended due dates come up and we haven't heard from them, I'd get them extended. That'd be my take. We probably will see a March and April 15th extension. That gets down to now a discussion with the clients about what that means. My position with clients is this right now. I'm telling my clients, look, this gives us an extension because situations could develop that would prevent us from being able to interact the way we normally do. In fact, in some places, that's already taken place where the interaction can't happen. For instance, I just saw a post on the Arizona Society listserv from a CPA who currently lives in a, you know, an area, one of these facilities that was set up for retirees, you know, those over a certain age, but it also has, you know, people who need medical care. You go into there, they do various levels of service. Well, you know, she just retired, so she's moved into that facility, but now she's been told that because of the concern for the situation in Kirkland, and because they have highly vulnerable people inside the facility, you know, inside that particular living area, that whole complex is going to be effectively on lockdown, in the sense that nobody other than the people that live there will be allowed in and out. So her clients cannot visit her now, not for any action she's taken, but for an action that's been taken for her. She also pointed out, which I think you do have to understand, if you've got clients who are in living facilities like that, there's a good chance that they're going to be into a lockdown situation, and conceivably, they could also at some point prevent those people from actually leaving and coming back because of the concern that they would bring the disease back with them. And if you've been watching the situation in Kirkland, Washington, you understand that it can be very devastating if it gets inside the wrong population, which it obviously did in Kirkland. So nursing homes, for obvious reasons, are getting very, very, very nervous in this area. So there's lots of reasons totally out of our control that we might have a block. Because of that, I'm telling clients, just go ahead and provide me the information. You know, don't decide that, oh, we don't have to file till, let's say, it becomes June 15th. I can take the next 2 months off. Say you do that and then something happens. And by the way, even if that something has nothing to do with COVID-19, you know, something happens and things happen to people, you know, you're going to not be happy that you blew this time. So continue to get stuff to us. Continue to move stuff our direction. Whatever method you are currently taking stuff in, I know some people are now down to electronic only. Some people are requiring clients to drop it off outside the office, not allowing them in. There are different reactions people are seeing. I'm not going to say what's appropriate reaction at this point. Well, that's a political discussion. Go on Twitter, yell at everybody you want to, whichever way you want to. That's not our discussion here, the tax-wise. But whatever the client can do, get the information to me like you would, you know, go ahead and do that, and, you know, we'll take care of it. But it's possible something could happen. You know, over a little week ago, I never would have thought a country would go ahead and, like, outside of China, would go ahead and shut down the whole area, and Italy just shut down first the northern part, then everything in the case of a week. Now we're seeing France and Spain take action, and, like, now it seems like it's possible. you know, that somebody might decide that, hey, we're just going to close all offices by definition. If they do that, that's going to affect our ability to do tax returns. So go ahead, move forward. We're going to keep going. The good news is for most of us here in tax practice, we can practice virtually. You know, I can get 99.9% of what I do, aside from assembling up paper copies of returns for people that want paper. I can get almost everything done from my location here at home that I get done if I went half mile down the road to my office to do it. But it's like, you know, so we're in better shape than many, but you got to be ready for those sorts of things to happen. That's why I tell clients, ignore the extension, right? If we have to use it, we will, but we're not going to plan our life. Yeah, you get an extended time to pay, take it, you know, good. And we can file and we can get your return done without you having to pay right away. But let's go ahead and move because we might need the time. Other thing happening now, we have a new bill, House Resolution HR 6201, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, that contains within it a bunch of other acts that we have there. It was passed by the House on Friday, 363-40-1, one abstention. There were some people who were not present, some of whom are, you know, self-quarantining. So it's kind of interesting, you know, how this thing works. But it passed, and it passed with, obviously, there's some opposition, but not huge, passed with clear majorities in both parties, unanimously by Democrats, and I think it was about 78% of Republicans who voted in favor of it. So seems likely that when the Senate picks it up on Monday, unless something's in that bill that nobody's noticed, there's some problem comes up, that's highly likely to be passed on Monday. And I should say, I told you the secretary put out a letter. He put out a letter specifically talking about how the Department of Treasury will advance taxpayers back payroll tax funds, it appears is what they were saying in the Wall Street Journal post this morning, back to taxpayers to help them meet the requirement for paid leave that would be in this bill for certain small businesses. It does contain sick time requirements that are, as I recall, temporary in this bill, but it's weird. While it's in effect, they would require you to accrue 1 hour for every 30 hours that an employee works. Now, I think 13 states already have that rule, including the state I'm in right now, Arizona. So for those states, that's not going to change. What would change for me here in Arizona is the carryovers would go to 56 hours. Current Arizona law says 24 or 40 hours are the maximum for a business, and the carryover can be no more than that maximum. It's going to be similar, no more than maximum, but 56 instead of 40, okay, or whatever for Arizona. But there also will be, in a public health emergency, which we just had declared, there will be an additional 14 days automatically required. If there are less than 50 employees in a group, there'll be an aid rule. Now, these rules apply only to employers of less than 500. We get into all that. I haven't had time to dig through the bill and find out what's there. There is a provision to provide money to employers who pay the special emergency leave. That's what Secretary Mnuchin was talking about this weekend in his release. The fact he's already telling us how it's going to work tells me that it appears highly likely they expect it's going to be enacted. I can't imagine if they were being told by the whips in the Senate that they don't have the votes. I have a doubt that we would be talking about this extension right now. So we'll see. The Wall Street Journal article, though, also did mention that there are some technical correction issues I've already found. So this may go back to the House for another vote after the Senate votes, just because there are some things, some glitches that need to be fixed. This time we're going to hopefully fix them up front. Don't be surprised if other technical corrections come up. But keep an eye on this bill. Your clients probably talked to you about this bill as well. Again, like the first thing we talked about here with the extension, right at the time I'm recording this at 8 a.m., now 8:15 a.m., here on the Sunday of March 15th here in Phoenix, don't have it passed by the Senate. But sometime next week, we expect it to be passed by the Senate. And sometime next week, I expect to see the extended due date. And when that happens, be ready because clients will start calling immediately. So you want to be sure you understand that. Okay, let's get into our standard update stuff now. We've wasted time, or not wasted, but at least done that, on the stuff that might very well have changed by the time you get into this. But we're going to talk about something I mentioned last week, an AICPA letter to the IRS asking specifically about the IRS's informal guidance on 199 Cap A. You may remember, following the issuance of the final regulations in January 2019, we've had a couple of places where the IRS has put guidance that has at times surprised us. For instance, they have their frequently asked questions page on their website for 19 Cap A, where they added that whole thing about having to subtract out self-employed health insurance twice, you know, essentially for an S-Corp shareholder, where the S-Corp takes it, reduces QBI at that level, but then when the shareholder claims the QBI deduction, they apparently have to reduce it again. They had discussions about other issues there. We also had in instructions this year, suddenly out of the blue, they listed as things that could reduce QBI that an S-Corp or a partnership would have to disclose, or you'd have to put on your 8995 or 8995A per the instructions, included charitable contributions. And it's like, what? So the AICPA wrote a letter to the IRS, and they asked them about this, you know, that as they quote said, we urge you provide additional certainty regarding which deductions are not reductions for QBI. Specifically, we recommend Treasury and the IRS confirm that various self-employed deductions under Section 164F, 162L, and 404 are not automatically reductions of QBI. Those three sections would be the self-employment tax deduction, the self-employed health insurance deduction, and the contributions to retirement plans, SKIOs and SEPs, would not automatically be reductions of QBI, and update the form instructions to reflect the same treatment for a charitable deduction under Section 170. Okay, what are they talking about here? Well, they're talking about here, like I said, those three deductions, the self-employed health medical deduction, KEO and SEP, and self-employed medical. And the IRS actually has two ways of looking at this. First, they're saying, well, let's assume that you have both. Let's take a simple example, somebody with an AGI of, you know, more than $100,000 above the threshold amount. They're married, so SSTBs get nothing. Well, if I have self-employment tax deduction, and I have both an SSTB business and a non-SSTB business, I should have to, you know, how do I allocate that self-employment tax? And the actual question 32 talks about gross income to make the allocation. They're saying, no, it seems to make a lot more sense, especially something like self-employment tax or the self-employed health insurance deduction or the retirement plan that are based on the net income of the entity, that should be allocated between the two options based on net, not on gross, right? First, you should clarify that, A, we don't have to take all of the self-employment tax deduction does not have to be taken against QBI, even though half of it came from this SSTB that we're getting no benefit from. But then they also said, too, you know, make it very, very clear. And they said, look, there's some cases where we have these items, like the self-employed health insurance deduction, for an S-Corp shareholder, where it's only allowed because it's been kicked back in the W-2. They're saying, look, we believe the proper way to handle that is to say the self-employed health insurance deduction is related to the W-2 income, and as such, it would not reduce QBI. Now, interestingly enough, while they quoted question 32 in the letter, they did not quote 33 because that position is clearly contrary to 33. Because 33, you know, you're not going to get a self-employed health insurance deduction as an S-Corp shareholder unless you have that number in your W-2. That's a requirement. So it's interesting that they avoided straight up saying that your guidance is wrong. They're just indirectly saying it's wrong based on the same logic as others. Okay. Now, again, it is an AICPA letter. So, you know, it has no standing, but it does give you their logic for why these things do not relate and shouldn't reduce QBI. If you are taking the position they don't, I suggest you look here for your defense. I still recommend to people that you consider disclosing if you're doing it, not because I think the IRS position is right, I think it's wrong, but because I happen to believe that the agent's going to follow that position in writing, and it may not be worth challenging. But the problem is you're going to have this penalty attached on by the agent. And, you know, I don't want to spend time having to argue the penalty off the return. You know, we may give up, we may do it, but I'm going to not argue the penalty. I don't want to have to pay that penalty, but you have to spend time getting rid of it. If you disclose, it is very difficult for the IRS to make a penalty stick. And I mean super difficult. That one would take about 2 seconds in appeals to get off if an agent was stupid enough. And there's only way to phrase it is stupid enough to push forward with that case and say there was no reasonable basis for the position. like I said, that's just, and I know sometimes you get people that are unreasonable and then their supervisor is also unreasonable. That's a double, but it doesn't often happen. They're both that unreasonable. But even if that's true, appeals is not going to let that go through. The burden's on the IRS for the penalty. So yeah, that's going to be tough. I would say go for it. The other problem the IRS had was a charitable contribution issue for QBI. Out of the blue, with the instructions for 8995 this year, they just suddenly add the blurb about, well, and reduce for appropriate charitable contributions. And they also mention charitable contributions for the S Corporation and for the partnerships in their instructions. And the AICPA, like I am, are a bit confused by this. You only report charitable contributions separately in a partnership or S Corp if they are going to Schedule A, they are 170 contributions. If those contributions truly relate to the trade or business, they are not charitable contributions, they are 162 deductions. In fact, the regulations under 162, including the proposed regulation 1.162-13 that came out recently, specifically talks about payments made to a charity that we expect are going to benefit our business, right? And so they become business deductions. The AICPA says, you know, as far as we could see, if a charitable contribution is being reported as a 170 charitable contribution, that is not a reduction of income, not going into computing AGI, then it shouldn't reduce QBI. And IRS, if there's some reason you think it should in some circumstances, you got to have some explaining to do here, because we have to understand how that would work. I agree. I think the IRS is dead wrong putting that in. I think if the expense really relates to trade or business, you know, I mean, I would tell the agent flat out, then let's move it above the line. I need a self-employment tax refund. Let's move it above the line. You know, I get my standard deduction now, right? You know, let's go ahead and move it above the line. Let's do that. You're telling me it's trade or business related. Okay, I think I'll accept that. You know, if we're going to take the hit on QBI deduction, then I want it above the line. And I want all the consequences of being above the line to come into play. Not sure the agents will like that answer. So the IRS did this. Now, this letter, of course, like I said, the AICPA can't force the IRS to do anything, right? The IRS might not do anything of the above, but it is interesting. And certainly, what I think this letter is really good for is for you to have backup and justification for the positions you're going to take for clients if you decide to take these positions. These positions that go contrary to what you see implied in the instructions are actually stated straight out in the frequently asked questions. You know, some of your clients may not want to take those positions that are contrary to those because they're just, as I say, 95% of clients are wimps and they just don't want IRS challenges. But your clients that want to go ahead and take it, I think you use this is your backup. So if you've not looked at that letter, we do have the link to the letter in the materials this week and on the website. If you have not looked at that letter, I strongly suggest you look at it and consider the actual resources it cites as to why, you know, this particular item should not reduce QBI. Next up, notice 2020-25. I know you're saying, wait, COVID-19 again? It's like, I'm tired of that. I've heard too much of it already. Yeah, I know. We're all getting there. And you know that too. Those of you watching the slides, as soon as you saw the little COVID, isn't it amazing how we've all gotten used to that picture of what the virus looks like, the little round thing with the little spiky things coming out of it? Yeah. Okay. Anyway. Yeah. We're going to talk about it one more time because this was an issue that came up. And actually, I've already gotten notice from my insurance carrier regarding that they are going to go ahead and follow this, even though they weren't required to in this state. They're going to basically pay for this stuff, even though the state doesn't require it. Some states did. There's a question because some states ordered insurers to pay for COVID-19 testing if a doctor ordered it without regard to any co-pays or any other, you know, amounts, that it just had to be fully covered. And my understanding is the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association asked the IRS, wait a minute, you know, a lot of our policies are high deductible health plan policies that insureds are using to justify making health savings account contributions. Now, if this type of paying for COVID-19 testing and COVID-19 treatment, if that is considered to be a payment that they shouldn't get reimbursed for until the deductible is paid, this is no longer a high deductible health plan and they can't make their HSA contributions, and or their employer can't. And that's kind of a problem. So the IRS issued this notice, okay, and it's going to provide an exception to the general high deductible health plan deductible rules, right, that we can pay for these things even if they're not. Now, we've all had the deal since the ACA that that it was okay if they paid for preventive care. And I think there was a reasonable level of comfort that any test done before a diagnosis, a formal diagnosis, is considered preventive care. So COVID-19 testing probably was okay, although we wanted some comfort level there. COVID-19 treatment, though, seemed to be a real problem under that rule, because that's not preventive. You've been diagnosed with the disease, right? You know, you've got it. That's treatment. That's exactly the sort of thing that's supposed to not be paid until you meet the deductible. Well, the IRS has ruled that a policy can now pay for both COVID-19 testing and treatment of COVID-19. And the reason why is because they're saying, you know, they're going ahead and allowing that as kind of a general exception under this notice. Recognize the current situation. We're going to allow for testing for COVID-19. We're going to allow treatment for COVID-19. By the way, I'm saying COVID-19 because that's technically the name. And secondly, it's a lot shorter to write than anything else that we can call this. And I'm looking at just trying to get a quickie thing that fits easy. So be aware of that. When you have to slide, you want to make sure you don't have too many letters in anything. So that works much nicer. But COVID-19 is what you've heard called the coronavirus. Okay. Hopefully nobody's confused by that, what they are. Okay. What they do by putting this notice out is we no longer risk, if you're in a state that has ordered the insurers to pay these without deductibles, you are no longer at risk of being unable to fund your HSA or having your HSA contribution made by an employer to be considered an excess contribution and then also be taxable wages to the employees. So it protects the ability to fund the HSA as a qualifying policy. Now, it does not change any other HDHP rules. So, yeah, they say nothing else changes. Don't try to expand this to something else. Don't try to take this to some other disease. You know, this is a special case. Be careful here. This is how this works. So, you know, don't go beyond it. But we have this coverage temporarily that we can use this for testing purposes. So if that happens, that's, you know, go ahead. As I said, my policy here in Arizona, issued by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona, I just got a notice from Blue Cross Blue Shield that, in fact, yes, they're going to pay for. I've got a high deductible health plan. They're still going to pay for any, if a doctor decides I need COVID-19 testing, they will pay for that test. So, fine. That's not a problem. The COVID-19 stuff they're covering. Now, finally, to a little more traditional problem we have in tax law. This was the case of Thomas versus Commissioner. Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2020-33, issued on March the 11th. We're back to mailboxes again. Yeah, this is, you'd think we could solve this problem because it's actually easy to solve. This is one of those things like the divorce cases that go to whether it's child support or alimony, where you go, we've solved this problem. It's easy to solve, but people keep doing the stuff that, you know, gets them in trouble. This was a case of Thomas. At least in Thomas's case, I guess good news, there was no professional involved. So, you know, it's always kind of funny we see a professional get, you know, where somebody went and had an attorney filing a petition with tax court and somehow that got fouled up because the attorney didn't use the safe methods. But in this case, it was a taxpayer who did it themselves. They're going to go pro se to tax court. Their tax court petition was due, as we would expect, right now. You get the notice of deficiency. You've got 90 days. The tax court petition told you the date, you know, the 90-day notice gave them the date to send it in by, and it was actually computed, right? It was the 90th day, right? Well, here's the catch. They took the envelope, right? Now, apparently, Mr. Thomas prepared, you know, did some of the work up front. Or no, was it Mrs. Thomas did the work up front. Then Mr. Thomas, got an envelope from her that had the petition, that had a, you know, apparently a metered, it says a private postmark, so maybe stamps.com or metered, we don't know which, but had a postmark date that was the last date from their meter, right? He apparently reviewed something else, signed, whatever he did, and then he seals it up and he puts it in a mailbox, okay? Well, it arrives at the tax court on day 98, okay? And when it gets there, there are two postmarks. That private postmark, right, let's say stamps.com or metered, has the last day that required for it to be filed. That shows a timely filing date. However, after it got put in the mailbox, It was later actually postmarked by the Postal Service. That postmark was one day later. So we have two postmarks on the envelope. Now the question becomes, you know, if in fact the U.S. Postal Service postmark is right, then 7805 7805 was the issue on the extension days. 7502 makes it very clear that, you know, that postmark date, you'd be behind. You know, if it's whatever date is postmarked by the Postal Service is the day you're deemed to have filed it, and he would have filed his petition one day late. And that's bad news because the tax court can't hear your petition. If you're one day late, you got to pay the tax and go to district court, which it gets a lot messier and more expensive. Well, what he said was, look, there is a rule. If there had been no Postal Service postmark on the envelope, the rule per the regulation is we look at with a private postmark is that postmark date on or before the last date for filing. The answer would have been yes. Then the second question was, did it arrive to the tax court in this case, because that's what it was, but to the IRS if it's a tax return, within a normal time frame for the Postal Service to deliver? And let's accept that the 8 days would have been within that normal range, because they've had weekends in there, etc. And we don't know, you know, how far they were from D.C. So let's accept 8 days was normal. You know, well, we should be fine. We postmarked it. You know, there's our private postmark. It arrived on a reasonable time to the tax court if it had been truly mailed on that date. So we're okay, right? Unfortunately, the tax court said, guys, here's a problem. You can't do that. The regulations make clear that if there is a private postmark and a U.S. Postal Service postmark, the Postal Service postmark takes precedence. You know, that's tough luck. You took the risk by putting it in a mailbox. Now, I know you told me it said it would be picked up by 5. You know, and sometimes, too, you know, like our mail carrier will take a letter, you know, and it'll take it back to the post office here. But that doesn't guarantee it gets postmarked that day, right? And so they're saying, well, maybe it got arrived, the pickup, it finally arrived back at the post office after they were closed. There are lots of reasons why it might not have gotten postmarked. Or it could just be they just didn't pick up the mail that day. Something went wrong and, you know, they didn't get there for the pickup that day. You know, truck broke down, whatever. It didn't go in. The tax court said, look, the law tells you how to fix this. And it does. If you use certified mail or registered mail and you have the white receipt stamped by a Postal Service employee, you're golden. The burden's now on the service to show that you didn't mail that document. The burden's no longer on you to show anything. You say, I put this document in. Here's my certified mail receipt. IRS, ball's in your court. They're going to have real trouble carrying that, and they don't carry it. You also could have sent it by an approved private carrier, right? You could have called FedEx. Now, make sure you take a look at the list of valid services when you do that. You can't just use any FedEx service. No, don't fall into the trap, which a couple of taxpayers did, of assuming if it's a next-day service, it's okay with FedEx. FedEx added a super early next-day service a few years ago that for a long time was not on the list because it didn't exist when the list was put together. The IRS update list came in there, but the interim, if you filed using that, you just proved it arrived at the tax court a day late, and the timely filing rule didn't apply to it because it was the wrong type of service. So always double-check your service. But you had ways to do that. If it's a tax return, the third way out is electronic filing, and East Postmark is also absolute proof of timely filing. You have all these options. You elected to drop it in a mailbox. When you do that, you're gambling that it will get postmarked in time. And if it doesn't, you bear the full risk of the late filing. So, gang, if you're going to mail something in, if you cannot file electronically because it's like a tax court petition or some other document, you want to make sure you use certified, right? Certified mail at the post office. Walk it in. Don't go to like a UPS store and let them do it. We had a taxpayer got in trouble with that a couple of years ago in a case, right? We saw that case a couple of years ago where a taxpayer tried that. It blew up because the UPS store didn't go to the post office till the next day, you know, or use the private delivery services and get the information you need to back that up. And that usually requires you to go in after you gave it to them to get the delivery record from them because they will not hold the delivery record long enough for you to get all the way through the statute if the IRS challenges you about timely filing. So make sure you go clear that up. There's some steps there. The simplest step is still by far certified mail at the post office. Just do it. That's what most people are doing. Certified mail at the post office. Fine. I don't care about anything else. And not proof of mailing. Not, you could take pictures. You can have somebody come in and videotape it. You can have everybody in the post office swear you dropped it off that day. It's not good enough. Remember, we went through that whole discussion a couple weeks ago where the Supreme Court in the Brand X decision told us that we had to follow the regulations when the IRS came out with them later, if they were contrary to a court decision, you know, prior court decision, the Ninth Circuit in the case Radio Stay, and this would have gone to the Ninth Circuit, as I recall. It's just tough luck. That's how it goes. Okay, IRS regulation must be followed by the court, and you need to follow it. If you want to protect your client should follow that regulation. Well, okay, it is CPE for 2020 times going to be coming up. Now, obviously, with all the stuff this week about various things happening, I feel like, hey, it's great. I'm actually doing live sessions right now anywhere, so I'm not too worried about what works and what doesn't. I will remind you, though, we still, you know, most of the sessions I do in Arizona anyway, I end up with many times over half the people take it have been in the webcast any event. So a lot of you guys here like to do it that way. Other parts of the country, it's similar. I see a lot of webcast people. I would expect the one outcome of all this ultimately is going to be that, yeah, almost all programs are going to be done both ways. Coming here shortly, there'll be a live session in room and there'll be a session that's broadcast. We'll see the broadcasting stuff rolled out broader. That's just my guess for the industry, but, you know, not saying anything official by Kaplan or the state societies on this. I'm just saying it looks really like there's going to be pressure to go that direction, and we're moving that direction anyway, so it's just going to speed up the inevitable. But in any event, we do have the live CPE, that is, and I mean live or live webcast coming up. Take a look there. I've told you before, I think it's key with the changes and things happening. It's really nice to have a true live broadcast. Yes, rebroadcast live is okay, but, you know, it obviously gets dated after a while, and you got to worry about that. We also have the problems with, you know, if you go to, you know, self-study, that tends to get put in the can and then not updated for a year or so, because just kind of how we work in the division. So make sure you take a look at your state society's offerings. Take a look at what they're giving you. As I say, currently, I'm not doing any, you know, I won't be scheduled to do another session probably until May or June. So I've got a little time to wait before we see what's happening anyway, shape or form that way. But, you know, you guys won't sign up for tax courses right now. That's a fundamental issue, so we're good there. But take a look, see what we have offering, and keep eyes here. We will tell you as I get aware of anything that's going to be happening that would be changes. I'll try to update you if something happens. But like I say, at this point, it's a little early to tell you what's going to be happening going forward. Just saying, though, I'm looking forward to doing sessions live, webcast, whatever way I end up doing them here coming forward. So we'll look at it that way and keep track of your state society for that. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. You can follow the updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also send questions or comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I do post on Twitter at edzollers. I plan to probably forward anything there that we hear from Treasury once we get extension dates, etc. We are certainly watching a lot there. The tag to follow is #TaxTwitter. That's probably the best way to search. And just put your little pound sign there, Tax Twitter, and you probably will find some things tagged there that may let you know if something happens. Also, I follow discussions on the subreddit /r/taxbros. I also have stuff. I follow the Connect sites for the Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota societies, where I'm members. I check in as well on California's Tax Talk, CalCPAs. And anybody around the country is open to join that one. The Connect sites tend to be open to the members of that society only. So that's how it works. But you can ask questions there. Certainly, by the way, those are great places to figure out what's happening when we get like extended due date rulings or we get other coverage or we get this new law on paid leave time. You're going to find a lot of discussions, a lot of things going up there. So again, I mean, sometimes people are going to, you know, say whatever. Don't take anything as absolute. This out works, no question. But certainly it's going to be useful discussions there, and certainly we're going to be posting stuff there and discussing there how these provisions work. So if you have access to a program like that, be sure you take advantage of it. So until next week, when we see if I can give you an extended due date and who the super rich are that don't get it, We'll be sitting here with current federal tax developments, and we'll see you back here a week from now when we'll be broadcasting again for the March 23rd edition of this program.